Finance Committee to order a work session. It's 10 minutes after 3 o'clock. And President Representatives Lehman, Finkelstein, Boyer, and Donnelly. And the first matter on the agenda is House Bill 434, Revolving Door Restrictions, Labor and Commerce Bill. And we have on teleconference network Edgar Paul Boyko from Anchorage. And Mr. Boyko, would you like to give some testimony to the committee on this legislation?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, first of all, let me say that due to the courtesy of your chairman, I received the original draft of the bill, which at that time was not numbered, and which was entitled An Act Establishing Certain Restrictions on Certain State Employees Before, During, and After State Service. I was invited to and did take the liberty of marking that up and incorporating certain suggestions, and that was faxed to the committee chair, and I don't know if you've had an opportunity to look at my suggestions. These address only Section 2 of the proposed bill. I'm not purporting to address Section 1. In Section 2, I have taken the liberty of suggesting that the following changes be made in the original work draft. On line 3 of Section 3990.030 as amended, I have substituted the word 2 for the year 1, for the word 1, making it 1 year, 2 years instead of 1 year, in order to bring it in line with the provisions of AS 39.52.180, which now provides a 2 year restriction on former state public officers representing clients in front of their, before their agents, former agencies, and that's a 2 year period. And I would respectfully suggest that there is no reason to make a distinction between that and a person becoming employed by a contractor in whose contract award the public employee has substantially participated. That's why that suggestion was made. On line 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of the same section, I have added the words or entity after person, because while I think a person probably covers not only an individual but a corporation, it is conceivable that it might be argued that certain legal entities may or may not be persons. That simply makes it a little broader. In addition to the 2 lines further, the word directly should be crossed out. It isn't on my draft here, but it was intended to be crossed out. And there was substituted for it personally and substantially, which again is based upon language elsewhere pertaining to this type of prohibition, and makes it more consistent and doesn't directly is something that would lend itself to a lot of legal quibbling, in my humble opinion. In the next line, I would have inserted the words procurement procedures that resulted in, I added the word or contributed to the award of the contract, because it would always be very easy to avoid the effect of this section by simply a public official who, let's be blunt about it, wants to feather his own nest and award a contract, he can always shield himself from directly result, from the direct result by delegating that to somebody else, as long as it sets the machinery in motion. And certainly if a person wanted to do that, that's what he would, I presume he would want to, he would do in order to get around the requirements. So it would now read, if the first public officer was personally and substantially involved in the state's procurement procedures that resulted in or contributed to the award of the contract. Those are all the changes, except that I also added after subsection 3B, which says it, which now reads, or originally read, A person who violates the section is subject to a civil penalty, etc. And then it says penalty imposed upon this section is in addition to and not instead of other penalties that may be imposed according to law, including criminal penalties. And then as I read that chapter, I did not find, I may have not looked in the right place, but I did not find any criminal penalties. So I added a subsection C saying a violation of this section is a Class A misdemeanor to add some teeth to this. I'll be very frank with you and tell you, generally speaking, what motivated me in becoming interested in this legislation. I don't want to beat around the bush. As some of you know, perhaps all of you, I became somewhat concerned about an award of a contract by the Department of Law last year on an emergency basis to a Seattle law firm. That contract was originally, proposal was originally written for $10 million to pay for legal services in connection with the oil spill litigation on behalf of the state. It was then, the $10 million in the proposal was later struck out and changed to $1 million. However, there were public statements by the Attorney General's office to the effect that it was expected to be probably a 10-year operation, so we're really talking probably about a sequence of 10 $1 million contracts at the very least. So we're really talking about a $10 million contract for the next 10 years, and it would certainly be very tempting for the persons who let this contract, and I have suggested, even though that suggestion has been previously rejected by some administration people, that that contract, award of that contract, violated both the letter and the spirit of the procurement law and regulations. And in the course of debating this with the Department of Law and Department of Administration persons and persons in the governor's office, the subject came up as to whether or not some of the people in the Department of Law who awarded this contract to a firm whose resident partners are all ex-Department of Law employees might be feathering their own nest. This suggestion was rather indignantly rejected, and maybe that's true, but it seems to me that in the absence of legislation such as this, the temptation would be incredibly great not only to award such a contract, whether or not in violation of procurement laws and regulations, but also for the person who has a hand in doing this, when his time comes to leave the government service, to jump right in there and accept a position which would be handsomely remunerated. Any law firm getting a $10 million contract through, let's say, the good offices of a highly placed deputy or assistant attorney general would be foolish not to put him to work for $250,000 a year. Even if he had nothing else to do, it'd still be just a finder's fee. So I think the temptation is extremely great, and I think it would be very much in the public interest to shut the door to this type of operation. That's all I have to say, Mr. Chairman, unless there are some questions.
We've been joined by Representative Collins. Are there any questions for the witness? We have no questions here. Thank you for your testimony. And the committee is going to look into drafting a committee substitute. Representative Lehman has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Boyko, you said that you did not look at the section number one on the restrictions on the insurance director. I just wondered if you have no comments, or you didn't look at it, or I've looked at it and I have some concerns about that. I just wondered if you might share any that you might have.
Looked at it. I don't profess to have studied the subject as I did the subject matter of section two, Representative Lehman. On the face of it, I don't see anything wrong with requiring the insurance commissioner to be free of any equity interest that might affect his judgment in dealing with companies in which he owns stock. And I think a year before and a year after taking this rather important position, which incidentally, just as a matter of gratuitous aside, I think ought to be upgraded as it has been in the state of California, because I think the experience has been that insurance, the directors of the Division of Insurance being under the control of the Commissioner of Commerce, tend to be rather hampered in what they can do in a very sensitive area. But that's neither here nor there. That's not before you. I just threw that in because I had the luxury of having the ear of some very important legislators. But I don't see anything wrong with it. But if you, sir, have some specific questions that I might be able to contribute something to, I would certainly invite you to specify so I might comment.
Thanks. I don't have any further comments right now, but I might at another time. If so, I'll give you a call.
Thank you, and I sincerely hope that the absence of questions indicates an absence of disagreement rather than the other way around, because if somebody thinks I'm out of line, I wish you would let me know so I can try to persuade you that I'm not.
We've been joined by Representative Gruenberg here. Possibly you could... I think when we talked about this legislation, when we originally introduced it, there was some discussion about the 1 versus 2 year requirement, and that the 2 year requirement would be pretty, it's a long time for somebody to wait after public service to go back into an area where they probably was their area of expertise originally, and might be quite a serious request to make upon people entering public service that they have to give up a year, their, you know, 2 years of their livelihood versus just 1 year when they come back out of public service. And if you could comment a little bit more on that, Mr. Boyko.
I do, because I think what you said, sir, is probably applicable to the section of the statute, which is AS 39.52.180, which now contains the 2 year restriction. This is the restriction upon public officers from representing clients or parties before their former agency. Now, that certainly affects their expertise. On the other hand, asking them to wait 2 years before they join a contractor who got the contract through their service, through their help, doesn't seem to be unreasonable to me at all, because it certainly only restricts their livelihood with respect to persons with whom they would have a conflict of interest. And I think that's a very modest period of time. They can certainly go with anyone else. Let's take the case of the Department of Law. If they award a $10 million contract for legal services to a Seattle firm, and they have to wait 2 years before they can go to work, that doesn't seem to be unreasonable, because during that 2 years, they can go to work in their field as lawyers with any other firm. But it does take some of the incentive away from just awarding a very lucrative contract and then jumping right into that at nest. And I think that is a great temptation when you're talking about these kinds of dollar numbers. So I don't think that may be a valid objection to the law as it now exists with respect to the other section which I just cited. But I think in this context, that's a very modest restriction, because let's say I'm a Deputy Attorney General, and I award my friends a $10 million contract, it would still be to their interest to put me on the payroll even 2 years after I leave office at a rather substantial salary, because I would have really done them given them a very valuable benefit. So the 2 years doesn't seem unreasonable at all, but it would certainly discourage the revolving door phenomenon that you gentlemen are trying to address, and ladies.
Thank you, Mr. Boyko. I just wanted to get a chance to address that question, because I know it will come up as the committee marks up this legislation.
I hope, Mr. Chairman, that you have made some notes of the reference to the other existing statutes, the 3952-180, because that's in there now, and I think it's more restrictive there than it is in this section.
Yeah, we appreciate you pointing it out to us, and we're going to take a look at it and see if we come up with a committee substitute. We're rapidly running out of teleconference time here, and unless there's more questions, anybody else have additional questions? We really appreciate you tying in with us today and giving your testimony and expertise on this. We really appreciate your advice on this matter. So thanks again for doing that, and we're going to sign off here from Juneau, unless you have any. You've got about a minute if you want to make any closing remarks.
It was just a direct call.
Courtesy of placing a call to my office that was very thoughtful, and I appreciate the opportunity to present my views to this august body, and I wish you Godspeed in your work.
Thank you, and we'll be signing off in June. Now. Thank you. Okay, so we're off the teleconference now, and is anybody? Oh, Representative Boyer.
You know, Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure how I feel about the idea generally yet, but I tend to feel that there are a lot of people around here who, you know, spend time in public service and acquire contacts and influence legislation while they're here, and not least of which among them are people who work in the executive branch on the third floor, and also things called assistant commissioners and special assistants. And those people are all very influential in the process, and I think it's, we'd be missing a huge group of folks that are very influential after leaving the state payroll. If we were not include the employees of the governor's office, the third floor office folks, I don't know if you call them those people serving in the exempt or partially exempt service over a level 21 or how you might get to this, I think we can, or whether or not we need to use the jargon, assistant commissioners or special assistants, you know, if we want to get that specific. But I think that you're only scratching the surface of the folks who are influential around here if you leave those folks out, if we move ahead with this.
Representative Collins?
I agree with Representative Boyer. I think he makes a really good point, is that there are a lot of people who are not yet at commissioner or deputy commissioner level, but who develop contacts and information and influence and can go on in the private sector. But, you know, another thing I think, too, and I know this might seem off the wall, but one of the things that I would see, too, is that a lot of these people that I've seen in the past, or some of these people in the past, to come back as a state employee, I don't think that they should be allowed to either, you know, use that influence while they're in the executive office to either go into the private sector or to become a state employee as well. I don't know if this is the bill to address it in there. That's a really good point.
Well, we're going to take a look at it next week or so here and see if we can do some more refining on the bill. So, you know, any suggestions you have, work with the staff, and we're going to try to, you know, we want to be as specific as possible, so it's not really vague who's covered and who's not covered, because you know the problems we get into when we deal with that. That's why we thought we'd just try to at least target the key policymakers. The other thing, we want to really address people who have a hands-on process with making, you know, some benefit going to somebody, and not just somebody who sets an overall public policy. Somebody setting a general policy type thing, that's okay, but you know, I don't think they should be limited from working for somebody later on. But if they were involved with a benefit going to a specific group, you know, had a role in that, then it's a different level, I think, of scrutiny. Representative Lehman?
On the restrictions on the insurance director, when we had our work session in, was it November?
Mm-hmm.
In Anchorage, I expressed some concerns about this owning stock or equity position, and you know, I think I brought up about a mutual fund or something like that where the ownership would be fairly minor. I hope that in our working that we can pick up some of those comments. Is that the intent?
Yeah, that is the intent. We're also going to look at the problem with the retirement and pension plans that are held by the state. If somebody's in a pension plan like that, you know, they didn't target it towards that particular group. I think there's ways to write those out of, you know, and discriminate between that type of involvement and others as more active.
I have a comment on, I'll just briefly make it now, and I'd be happy to work with the junior staff. If we make it so restrictive, I mean, who are the people who are qualified to serve as insurance directors? I mean, I assume it's a pretty small set of people out there in the industry, and we need to make sure that we have that group of people available to us to serve, and yet at the same time, I think it's proper to put certain restrictions on so they're not gaining financially unnecessarily. And it's just a concern that I have. I don't know how small that set of potential people is, but I would assume it's fairly small.
Mr. Koch, I know you signed up to testify on this, but we're going to be working with it some more. And
I can add comments now or later.
Okay. Well, I'd like to move on with the agenda to take up House Bill 406 this time, and we'll come back to it later on. So I'd call the meeting to order as a hearing and invite the sponsor of House Bill 406 to sit with us and give testimony. We're not on teleconference.
No. All right. Well, thanks for hearing the bill. It's one of those bills that we always wish we didn't have the information we did. But you may or may not know that there was an incident in my district that brought to my attention a problem that we have, and this legislation addresses that problem and proposes that that we by law require that electrical devices sold in the state have the proper safeguards to prevent people from being injured or killed. The bill is before you. I don't know if in your package you have, there's a proposed set of amendments to it that we've received from some representatives from UL, and they're here to testify today as well, by the way, so you'll have the benefit of their expert testimony. Also, Scotty Hawkins from the Department of Law Consumer Protection Division is also here. He was the person directly involved with the investigation of the incident that took place out in Peters Creek. Also, I got a letter from Bev Ward DeMarco expressing some concerns about those people who may be disposing of or selling used equipment, and how would this bill affect that situation. So that question may come up as well, and I can respond to it, and I think people from UL could as well. It's pretty straightforward, though. Either UL or another third-party certifier would be required to attach a label on an electrical product that was sold in Alaska. The lamp that was sold that brought this to my attention wasn't approved by UL or any other third-party certification certifier, and I don't know if people have had the incident described in detail, but I'll do that just for your information. There's a electric lamp that had a cord that ran up through the middle, the stem or the or whatever you call it, that then got up to the light bulb. And in order to put this lamp together, they had to screw the legs on and screw the table on, and in doing so, they applied the screws right through the wire, so the whole lamp was hot when it was plugged in. Of course, it had a pretty terrible result. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be glad to attempt to respond and offer to introduce the other people that are here to testify.
Speaker Cotton, I have signed up to testify Jim Drake from Alaska Bustle Electric and Bob Pollock from Underwriters Laboratories. If you want to just join us at the table here, we could call them up.
What about the attorney from the Department of Law? Is that person signed up?
Is there somebody else here to testify?
My mom's. He'll be here.
Okay. All right. Mr. Drake, do you want to come forward? If you would just have a seat there and identify yourself for the record. If you could just hold on just a second here. Okay, if you could just state your name for the record.
My name is Jim Drake. I'm the Vice President of Alaska Bustle Electric. And I guess I'm here to urge you to amend House Bill 406 by inserting the words "or installed by a licensed electrical contractor," as noted in the state, whatever the statutes are. I don't have those numbers in front of me. The primary intent of this bill, as I understand it, is essentially to protect the public in a resale type atmosphere. And as a licensed electrical contractor, the way I would read this bill would mean if we take a job and go in and say we're going to redo a restaurant, it's quite common that we might take out fixtures, put up new fixtures, and then those old fixtures become our possession. And again, as I read this law, that would require that we would take these used fixtures and then have to have the testing laboratory certify them through some process that's yet to be determined. I guess I'm dismayed by that, because we've already had to pass tests as licensed electrical contractors, and those tests are given by the state. So in effect, I see you've kind of created a Department of Redundancy department. You know, if we go forward with this in 2 years, maybe we could come back and issue regulations to regulate the regulators. I mean, at some point, I think you have to say enough is enough here. Certainly, we deplore the incidents that happened in Peters Creek, and I certainly have no problem with correcting that part of it. But as a licensed electrical contractor, those would be my concerns. And again, I just make the point that we are licensed. From the contractor point of view, the only productive result that I would see coming out of this bill would be to increase our costs and further the nests of the testing laboratories. That's all I have to say.
Okay,
thank you.
Questions for the witness? Representative Cotton?
I better not. Go ahead.
Okay. Representative
Newman? Mr. Chairman, I have a question for either Representative Cotton or Mr. Drake. And the ASTM requirements for a testing laboratory, I haven't read those particular requirements. I don't know if you're familiar with them. Are there any laboratories in Alaska that would qualify or under those requirements, or is this a national, like a UL-type laboratory, or are you aware of any laboratories that would qualify?
I'm really unqualified to answer that.
You don't know? Do you know?
I don't believe there's any laboratories in Alaska. One of the amendments here that we're going to offer, they aren't in the packet?
They're part of the underwater
map. Yeah. There's a recommendation is to get rid of the ASTM and go with the ANSI. There's a difference. It's the American National Standard Certification program. But I don't know what you're leading to, but is there some place like for an Alaska manufacturer to get involved with this without having to ship product outside? Perhaps that's what you're getting at.
Representative Cotton, these are the amendments you're referring to.
I've got these right here. I don't know if they've been made available. Are these in their packet?
No.
All right.
Mr. Chairman, if I can respond to that. My thinking was, if we have products that are not now listed, that are in service, those wouldn't be barred from being able to be used. They're just barred from being sold, bartered, transferred. And my point is there anybody else who can certify those and say, Alaska, are we going to have to take those products, ship them off, or a sample of that product, ship it off to a laboratory outside the state of Alaska and get it listed?
The alternative to this legislation could have been that you can't use them in Alaska. And we decided that might be a little bit difficult to enforce. And so we decided to, for this bill, suggest that they can't be sold or exchanged for value. I'm not sure what this gentleman's problem is, but if there's a light fixture that doesn't have a UL sticker on it right now that's in the building, this doesn't say that you can't use that. But if somebody takes it out and then tries to sell it, this legislation would prohibit that.
Right, and all I would like to do is get the answer. Maybe I'm not saying you have to have the answer, but I'd like to find the answers. Where can we have that done? Let's say we take that fixture out, and where can we get it?
Right, why don't you wait on where can we get it? He's a gentleman from UL.
So we do have somebody from UL signed up to testify. Right. And are there any further questions of this witness?
Yeah, I was just curious about some of the comments you made, like feathering the nest of their organization. I mean, I don't know if you're familiar with UL, but they're a nonprofit corporation. Did you know that?
Yes. Okay, I guess.
So I was surprised that you might suggest that they were trying to feather their own nest somehow.
Well, I see a distinction between resale and contractors, and this just lumps everybody in together. And I haven't seen your amendment, so maybe they address that. But that's where I see a problem as the contractor. Again, they're already licensed. You've got bonding on them. You've got them licensed. I don't see that this does anything but drive up the cost of small business.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I wouldn't mind dealing with the dialogue here for a moment. What my proposal says is that you can't sell or otherwise deliver a product that isn't tested and proven to be safe. Now, I suppose I'm not sure how that would affect you as a contractor, other than you wouldn't be able to install something unless it was tested.
Right. See, that's my point. Is that
you want to be able to install things that haven't been tested?
My point would be that you've already licensed the electrician or the business, and that they should be qualified to determine whether this switch or this piece of conduit or whatever is serviceable or whether it isn't. And if you took this to the strictest sense, you could argue that if you went in and did a remodification of a building, that you need one of these labels, you know, on a piece of conduit that, you know, maybe we took the box from this wall and put it over on this. You know, the electrical business, every job is almost a custom job. And I can see where you could really drive up the cost tremendously. And, you know, from a liability standpoint, we're already on the hook because we've done the job. If there's a, you know, the light switch burns down the building, obviously the owner of the building is going to go back to the contractor that installed it and say, you know, you didn't allow the job, I'm going to sue you.
Well, that's, the, you know, the point is, I don't expect you to do a lousy job, but if you install a faulty product, you know, that's what I'm trying to prevent these faulty products from even showing up in Alaska. And that's what that was the incident here. I think the folks are going to, you know, show the piece of merchandise that brought this to my attention. But that's the point, not that we don't trust electrical contractors, but there are products that get installed that aren't safe. I mean, that happens. And so if you say it's against the law to install or sell products that aren't safe, well then, I don't see how that would affect the ability of a small business to make a profit or keep going.
Well, other than you're continually running at, you know, when you remodel, you're going to end up with these fixtures or boxes or some kind of switch gear, and you know that's obviously going to have to be retested before it could be put back in service, or presumably it would have to be retested.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you might want to wait to hear from UL on that. We discussed that in context of the letter from Atlanta Crisfield here. I think the only problem is if somehow the label gets lost, then you've got to get it tested. But I don't know. It's my understanding that those labels don't just fall off very easily.
I've been on a lot of construction remodel sites and old fixtures. I've seen the UL marks on from old fixtures.
Well, I think the majority would have them on there. This isn't the greatest example, but that's the best one I can come up with on this short notice. But I know, like I say, my concern would be that almost all electrical jobs are different from each other. And you know, I hope we're not, by writing this, we're not meaning that every stick of conduit, you know, has to have a label hanging off of it that has been certified by somebody.
Yeah, just a note, I worked as an electrician 1 year myself, but wasn't required to take any tests or know anything, and was installing, you know, equipment and so forth. I worked for a legitimate contractor, but I was the guy, and you know, I didn't pretend to have, you know, any special training or anything. So if I would have been prohibited from installing something that didn't have a label on, well, there would have been a higher degree of safety than to have counted on me to, you know, untrained person. I guess that's my point.
Okay. Representative Finkelstein?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to make sure I completely understand what you're saying. The when you are installing an electrical device, you don't do any disassembly or anything to see that it meets some electrical standards. For instance, on light fixtures or something, you don't actually, as a matter of course, disassemble, do you?
No, I wouldn't think so. You know, as a matter of course.
So it seems that this bill does address a somewhat separate area, because the testing involves essentially a disassembly, or at least an examination of those components that make up the electrical device, rather than the correct installation of that device. I mean, that seems to be the two different areas involved. I just want to clarify, this is different than
Representative Boyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Last week we were entertaining a bill that kind of dealt with retrofitting of homes sold by AHSC, the intent being that we wanted to discourage the construction of substandard housing, and it appears that one of the goals of this particular piece of legislation is to discourage the sale, or in fact prohibit the sale of untested electrical devices in the state of Alaska in the future. And perhaps one way to get around or get to that goal would be to insert a phraseology on line 12 that said electrical product manufactured on or after the effective date of this act. And what you're getting at is prospective appliances or electrical products, and so you don't get into the retrofit problems that I think you're suggesting, and yet you still get at the problem that the sponsor of the bill, I think, is one of the goals that he's trying to accomplish.
think we might entertain some language at the appropriate time.
Representative Lehman, were you seeking recognition?
I wasn't, but
Mr. Chairman, I didn't know.
But I guess I'd let the sponsor of the legislation respond to that. I was just thinking that probably wasn't his total intent, but it was part of his intent, but I would suspect that it's also to make sure that any appliances that exist now that are installed become safe, you know, at least they're motivated to make them safe through the banning on the transfer sale or something like that.
Committee ready for the next witness? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. Pollock, do you want to join us? You can just state your name and where you're from for the record.
My name is Bob Pollock. I'm the senior staff engineer with Underwriters Laboratories at their Santa Clara, California office. Let's hear my comments first, or do you want to ask questions?
No, go ahead.
Okay. In reviewing Bill 406, we have sent a letter to Speaker Cotton. I believe you'll have copies of that, some suggested revisions to the bill. The main thrust of these revisions have to do with the standard that is being referenced for the accreditation or approval of the testing laboratories. The present standard mentioned in the document is an ASTM, which stands for American Society of Testing and Materials, and it's titled the Standard Guide for Laboratory Accreditation Systems. That document is really for an agency or somebody who is going to accredit laboratories. It tells you the guidelines for the accreditor. It does not cover the guidelines for what a testing laboratory or a certification laboratory has to meet in order to be approved by some agency. It really doesn't have the requirements that you're looking for. The document that we suggested was an ANSI standard, which I believe you have copies of as well, titled the Certification for Third-Party Certification Program. The American National Standards are consensus standards developed for the U.S., and this document does contain requirements that could go beyond just a testing laboratory. They contain requirements for what standards they can use, the follow-up of products once they are evaluated by a testing lab to make sure the production runs still meet the requirements, and they just talk about having some kind of certification mark so that people in the field can readily identify that the product has met the requirements and has been tested. In response to the previous witness's comments, licensed electrical contractors are trained and use the installation codes, the National Electrical being the main one, and that's the one that's used in Alaska. The contractors and the electrical inspectors are looking at installations. They are not looking at the manufacturing process of a product. They don't have the necessary background or the facility to go out and test products, for instance, a light fixture. We may conduct temperature tests. You're not likely to do that in the field to verify that a product would be acceptable. They look for a third-party certification mark to make things easier in the field. If they see that mark, they and the inspectors, the contractors and inspectors, will know that the product's been tested, and as long as they meet the installation requirements in the National Electric Code, then they shouldn't have any problem. It was realized a long time ago that people in the field, it would be very difficult for you to have to check out every product in the field. You don't know what materials were used in there. You don't know some of the other criteria or some of the hazards that may need to be addressed. It would be very difficult putting that burden on somebody in the field who has all the equipment to do all the proper testing.
Any questions for the witness?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to, I guess, offer my question that I offered before. Let's say that there are light fixtures or other electrical products that are not currently listed that are taken out of service and then wanted to either be sold or put back into service. What would be the procedure if there were a lot of them, you know, a number, would a representative sample be submitted to your laboratory, your testing, would you request just a sample and it actually physically have to be shipped and then it would be tested and then that would represent the batch or the process?
In a case where you have used equipment, what UL normally works with manufacturers, if you have used equipment, if it's a large piece of equipment, maybe one of a large motor drive or something, we can do an engineering evaluation on that product and give a report to the inspection authority as to whether or not it meets our requirements. If you're talking about 100 light fixtures that were in a building that's been remodeled and took them all out, you would have to inspect every one of those fixtures because you wouldn't know whether or not there was a problem with them. You don't know what the materials were used. It would be quite difficult for UL to go out and list that product. Or 2 minutes to come up, then those can be handled on an individual basis by the inspection authorities and the contractors as to what has to be done. Maybe on a light fixture, you can take a look at it and determine something. Maybe you can call our office and we give them some advice. It's not really going to be cost effective to send somebody out to look at a particular light fixture, send it back to us and look at it from that standpoint. But I think if you, your amendment that was talked about was the time of date. After a certain time frame, things have to meet the requirements. And then things before that date, then they should be looked at on an individual basis and see whether or not you want to accept that, or maybe you don't want to accept it. If you have a lot of units that have been used, they may have potential hazards in them. You don't know that. They're not certified. If you're willing to accept it based on the information at hand, that's a decision the local jurisdiction, the state or county can make. But if you really don't have anything to rely on in that case, you may be able to find the manufacturer may not. But we would suggest that you ask for the certified product to begin with and then handle the others as needed on an individual basis.
Okay. Does that capability exist in the field, like in the state of Alaska, where the capability exists for people to go out and make those observations? And then would that carry the... Could they place your seal on it? I mean, do you have field engineers and technicians that would do that type of thing?
We have an employee in Anchorage that works for us. We have a number of accounts in Alaska. We have done a number of field engineering evaluations in Alaska. In most cases, we have not applied a certification mark because it's a complete canning factory that was shipped over from the Far East. But we've given our best estimates as to the inspector as to what the concerns he should look at, and they've been able to work out then some revisions to that. In certain product areas, we can apply a label in the field if we can determine that all of the aspects of the product meet our requirements. When any test lab puts a certification mark on a product, what they're saying is that, to the best of their knowledge, they've looked at all the reasonably foreseeable hazards. In some cases, on a field product that may come from some unknown origin, advice on those, and as well as UL, there's other test labs.
So, like, why are you have it marked so many feet? Now, if you cut conduit into small pieces, you're going to have parts that don't have a listing mark on it. But if you were in a room such as this here, you'd be able to look around and you'd see the mark every once in a while, and you'd be pretty sure that that's what they use listed conduit throughout. In my experience dealing with electrical inspectors throughout the West Coast, that has not been a problem with conduit. They can look at that and look at the thickness and look and see if it's got rough edges or it's got rust or something if there's a question. Where they need to get another agency involved or another test lab would be on some complicated equipment. Maybe they shipped a motor control center that's the size length of the wall. Maybe need some help on that.
Okay. Further questions for the witness? Representative Collins.
I have one. Maybe to both can answer the sponsor of the bill. That in terms of looking at the bill and the purpose of the bill is to really protect the consumer in terms of making sure that products that are potentially hazardous aren't available to the public. The bill, as I read it, or the thought that comes to mind, that basically relates to anybody selling these products in the state. But what about like catalog sales? A lot of these products are available through catalogs. I know a lot of people in Alaska buy a lot of these products through catalogs. And how is this legislation going to make sure that, I mean, that if somebody lives in Anchorage or in Juneau, they might be assured that if they go down there and buy a piece of electrical equipment, that it's relatively safe. But if they buy one for 50% less out of a catalog, what assurances are that same safety standard is going to be there for people in catalog sales? So I guess my question is, does this apply to catalog sales? Because I know a lot of them occur in Alaska.
Thank you,
I'll hazard a guess, and I don't know if you're hearing from the Retail Association, but I think we had that question once before on catalog sales and whether or not if you bought something in a place where they had a sales tax, since you're buying it here, the sale is being made here. So it'd be my opinion that that it would apply to those people who sold the electrical products by mail order, and that they wouldn't be allowed to sell them unless they were tested and approved. I mean, that would be what I'd want to have happen. As you say, the point is to try to protect consumers in Alaska. So if they buy it from your store or my store or from a catalog, it really shouldn't make any difference.
It's not clear in the bill.
It isn't clear, so thank you. And by the way, Mr. Chairman, I'm not in a big, giant hurry on this. I want to make sure it gets done right, so I appreciate the work that you put in.
Okay. Representative Collins?
The other question I have, too, is looking at the wording of the bill. And it says a person may not, in the course of the person's business, offer to sell, give away, et cetera. If what comes to mind is in terms of, again, protecting the public, is when you look at, for example, like auction sales, or I guess it would include like an auction sale, or a secondhand store sale, but it wouldn't include, like, for example, the garage sale where you go to somebody's garage sale and they have lamps and things for sale.
I don't think it gives an exception there. It says in the course of a person's business, so that may exempt a person that is selling something out of their garage, since that wouldn't be in the course of their business. But and that person may not have to, or may not be, maybe they shouldn't be required to assume the same responsibility as the person who, in the course of their business, should know better. But if you put a lamp without the UL sticker out on your garage sale, I'm not sure you should be held the same degree of responsibility.
Yeah, this may be a question that really we want to take up further down the line in another committee, but and it's a legal question. In the Uniform Commercial Code, AS 4502315, implied warranty fitness for particular purpose, and I'll read it to you. If the seller at the time of contracting has reason to know a particular purpose for which the goods are required, and that the buyer is relying on the seller's skill or judgment to select or furnish suitable goods, there is, unless excluded or modified under another statute, which is related to this, an implied warranty that the goods shall be fit for that purpose. And has been used as the basis for a legal recovery when they turn out to be defective or dangerous. That's already in the law, and we also, of course, have strict liability in tort. When a seller or a manufacturer sells something that is defective, and it is, there's something that is simply unsafe about it, that's all you really have to show, and show that in fact caused the injury, then you have established the legal duty of care.
and that itself achieves the result that there can be recovery if it's in the context of the suit. Neither one of these is, of course, a criminal penalty here, and this makes it an unfair trade practice in Section 2. But aside from that, I was wondering if somebody could, or maybe the sponsor could be thinking as we get this down the line, why current law doesn't cover this, because it seems to me that if the industry standard in a lamp, such as what appears to be there on the floor, lamp base, is unfit because it's unsafe, I would think that right now you're covered under the UCC, and that covers all merchants who are dealing in the normal course of business, and this is what we're dealing with here, and also the concept of strict liability in tort also covers merchants as well as manufacturers.
Tim Cott?
Yeah, well, this is sort of a pro-tort reform approach to it here that I'm coming with.
I knew it. Magic words.
Thinking about preventing this, this gives an opportunity for either the Department of Labor, whoever may be charged with enforcing this section, to prevent you from selling it, not waiting until someone's injured and then there's a lawsuit. You know, I'm not thinking about recovery. I'm trying to think about it from the other end of it. So that's the short response to your comments there. And I do see what your point is, that there is some protection in that a person could recover, but until something happens, there's no way to prevent the merchandise from being offered for sale.
So what your goal in this is, Representative, is to be able to have administrative or injunctive relief to stop this from being placed on the market or taken off the market.
Right, I want it to be illegal to sell it. Otherwise, dispose of it.
Okay. Sir, did you have a comment?
Yes, this is a proactive way of handling the situation, and it's not unique to Alaska. Oregon and Washington have laws, as well as the city of LA and other communities, requiring the products be listed. And they have, Los Angeles has gone so far to have people go out to check shelves. They have a group that goes out and checks to make sure that products are labeled by one of the laboratories that they are accreditors that they accept. To help the public out, because in some cases the public may not be aware of what's happening. And this is a move to protect them. And in Washington, it's illegal to will a spa, electric or gas spa, to somebody unless it's listed, because you're at such a risk. If you're in that water and there's a problem, you're liable to be dead. There's no doubt about that. It's a very hazardous situation unless it's built properly. And this, by having required a product certifier mark, a product certification mark on the product, then there's some assurance that that product's been evaluated to a nationally recognized standard for safety.
Mr. Chairman, I think that what you need to do is, and I understand what you're saying, the way this is written now, and you may want to take a look at this as the bill progresses, the way it's written now, it does not provide any enforcement mechanism in Section 1 at all. That would simply, it seems to me, be the same kind of a thing that is in the UCC at the moment, but a very specific application of that. With respect to Section 2, that makes it an unfair trade practice and adds it to the list of unfair trade practices and would be something that the Consumer Protection Division could deal with. The Department of Law. But the Department of Labor wouldn't be involved with this at all. It would be strictly an unfair trade practice in the Department of Law. Was that your intent, Representative?
Well, maybe I just misunderstood how we did this, but on page 1, line 18 and 19, we say that the person who violates any of the sections is guilty of a violation.
What it says is the Consumer Protection Section of the Department of Law shall maintain the list of testing laboratories. This would, at least potentially, allow somebody to be prosecuted by the DEA, but Section 2 is in the Consumer Protection Division of the Department of Law, makes it an unfair trade practice. It's not under the DEA, it's under the Consumer Protection. It would be under both, actually. I don't know, and I think we probably have to hear at some point in the committee process from the the Department of Law whether, in fact, they would enforce this through the Consumer Protection Office or through the DA's office. I suspect in something like this, you're probably going to be looking at going through the Consumer Protection Office.
There's a representative from Consumer Protection here today to testify.
Oh, I didn't see that on the list. Who is that person?
I'm Scotty Goggins, sir.
Okay.
Oh, okay, good.
Did you sign up on another list?
I'm afraid I signed up on the list after I came in the door, sir.
Oh. Oh, okay.
Electrifying.
Any further questions for this witness?
If I had known he was here, I wouldn't have asked you.
Okay.
Representative Boyer, just for the record again, I said it kind of quickly, but I mean, we don't want to discourage dumping of substandard products in any marketplace, and there could be a problem with inventory that people have already purchased or contracts that have already been let in the upcoming season. So I think I heard you say, and not specifically for those reasons, but that a date, or effective date, a specific in time, provides for perhaps a non-disruption of an existing contract to construct a building or something, new things, and so that you would support the language that talks about manufactured on a specific date in time, and then having a specific date in the act itself.
Yes, it's very common to have effective dates in our requirements as well as the National Electric Code when something comes up to give manufacturers time to, you've got a pipeline effect, you've got an inventory, and if it's a serious hazard, you don't want them to use it. But if not, you want to give them a little time to get that out of the way so that you can get the new production out there.
Thank you. Further questions for the witness? Okay, thank you.
I'll stay around.
Yeah. Mr. Dawkins, did you want to testify?
Yes, sir.
Just state your name and who you're with for the record.
My name is Ronald Dawkins. Most people call me Scotty. I'm an investigator with the Consumer Protection Section of the Department of Law. I want to thank you, Chairman Donnelly, members of the committee, and Speaker Cotton for the opportunity to be here today. I want to stress that I'm not speaking for the administration. They've taken no position on this bill. I am merely here to present the committee with the lamb that killed the child. My testimony as to the investigation into that lamb, and offer the committee the opportunity, recognizing that I am not an attorney, to speak to how I see this bill being enforced by our office. This is a photograph of the lamp that killed the Crystal Thays. I had a telephone call on the 4th of December from an APD officer saying it looked like we had a problem, that it wasn't a criminal act that they were looking at, it was something that you should get involved in. Quite frankly, the Consumer Protection Section doesn't generally get involved in hazardous products, but we sometimes act for the Consumer Product Safety Commission as their sort of northern eyes and ears, being they have no presence in this state, CPSC being a federal agency that oversees consumer products primarily used in the house, looking at them from a safety standpoint. And I get involved in the investigation. Within a very few days, we realized that, yes, there was a serious problem with the lamp, and we asked the Department of Labor and the University of Alaska to help us to try and determine what was the problem with the lamp, and to also determine whether there may have been a problem in the home, which I believe was wired by the Bustle Electric Company. But there was no problem noted with the wiring in the home. In fact, the inspector noted that it was a very clean job. Looking at the lamp, and I'm going to pass it around for the committee to have the opportunity to see as we're talking, you'll see you don't have to be a rocket scientist to recognize what the problem is. The lamp stem, sometimes called wireway or raceway, is used to run the power cord, the A-Leet 110-volt power source, up to the lamp holder. The three legs of the lamp are affixed to that lamp stem, wireway or raceway, by six self-tapping screws, all of which are long enough to contact the wire running up the center of the lamp. In the case of the lamp that killed the child, the screws contacted the hot wire of the lamp, and after some period of time pierced the insulation and caused the 110-volt potential to be on the frame of the lamp, waiting for the child to crawl over what it has been doing for months and attempt to haul itself up on the lamp to steady itself as it stood. At that point, the insulation was pierced and the lamp electrocuted the child. This lamp that you're handling was taken from the home of a set of grandparents. They were Anchorage residents. And that home, when I picked the lamp up, was a 10-month-old baby boy crawling around on the floor. In this case, the insulation of the neutral wire was pierced, not presenting an electrical hazard, but if you look at it, you can see it was 1/32nd of an inch or less away from causing the same problem. A third lamp's being phoned up in the Fairbanks area, and the Consumer Product Safety Commission office down in Seattle now has that lamp. They received it last Thursday, and upon their initial evaluation, they found a contact with the insulation. They did not determine whether there was any piercing of the insulation. The lamp is now on its way to Washington to see if there was an electrical hazard with that lamp also. I'm assured by CPSC that they're taking this matter very seriously. They have went back to the importer, which is a California importer, by the way, who sold the product to an Alaskan retailer. And if they find that this problem is further than the three lamps, there's going to be a nationwide recall. Unfortunately, it's a little late for Crystal Phase. This thing got me kind of personal. I get kids myself at home. Many of us do, or we have grandchildren. And I think that everybody I've spoke to presumed that products like lamps were tested by somebody. I know I was of that assumption. And I've spoke to a number of attorneys in our department who also were of that assumption. But I always thought that there was a UL requirement. If you look at that lamp, there's a UL lamp holder. And I know when I talked to the retailer briefly before her attorney got involved, and our conversations are now somewhat stifled, she said it was a UL listed lamp because it has a UL listed lamp holder. That does not meet the criteria. The lamp was not a UL listed product, and UL has told me this design of lamp, which we found a second latent defect in, would never have been approved by UL. I'd like to give the committee the opportunity to bounce whatever questions you have off of me, especially the enforcement questions that were being directed earlier.
Okay, Representative Boyer.
Before we get to enforcement questions, that's exactly what I noticed first, is that the lamp holder where the plug or the light bulb goes into is a UL. And how do you deal with the issue of what is a composite product? I mean, pieces came in from different places, whatever is manufactured or assembled somewhere, and so part of it, you could easily guess that the whole lamp has been tested, and in fact it hasn't been tested or hadn't apparently been tested at all.
I posed that question yesterday to UL, and again this morning we went over it. I have an understanding of it myself as to how I can determine if a lamp is a UL listed product or not, and we have done some public education to have the consumer look for the UL oval label on the lamp holder or on the base of the lamp that indicates that the lamp is a UL listed lamp. I can see, and I agree with you, sir, that the using of the UL listed component in an assembly like a lamp can fool the consumer. It did in this case. At least the retailer assumed it was a UL listed product because of the holder, but that was a mistake. I don't know if that's...
Well, I suppose it leads to the investigation aspect. I mean, now that you're aware of it, it becomes something that would be standard in any investigation you would have. It would be to look further than just the light bulb holding mechanism.
Basically, if I'm looking at a lamp from this point forward, I look for the sticker. From the sticker, I look for the listing number. From the listing number, I go to the UL catalog. From the UL catalog, if I can't find the answer, I have a telephone number and a name I call. But up until a month ago, I had no idea that that was the case. And I don't think anybody else did either.
Representative Lehman, this is just one of the interests. You said you found a second defect to this other than that?
Yes. In the lamp holder itself, the guidelines established by UL call for tinning of the wires as they affix to the lamp holder. This particular lamp has lug-type stick-on connectors. They are so long, they prevent the proper assembly of the lamp holder. And there's an electrocution hazard in the assembly of the lamp holder not being completely assembled and allowing a break in what's called the fish paper insulation. There was two areas by which this lamp could have killed someone. Okay.
Further questions for the witness? Representative Collins?
I have a question. Was this lamp assembled in the U.S. or outside of the U.S.?
The lamp was shipped to the U.S. in a partially assembled condition. The owner, the purchaser of the lamp, and in three of the cases that I've chased down, purchased the lamp and had to fix the shade, the glass table, and the three legs. One of the lamps, the one that came from Fairbanks, the one that's down at CPSC, was sold in an assembled condition.
And then the other question I had, how about enforcing catalog sales? How would you do that?
We consider the Alaska statute, there's a long arm statute. And we would consider, and we have, in fact, we often deal with our mail order catalogs or our telemarketers that are coming into the state, and we are able to enforce our laws quite successfully against them. It gets a little bit more complicated, it gets a little bit more expensive, but it's not a major problem.
But you will be able to monitor catalog sales and make sure that...
Well, only to the extent, though, that the consumer protection and enforcement section out of Anchorage is one lawyer, myself, and a secretary. There's limited amount of resources available.
Did you finish?
No, I have one question.
Certainly.
The concern that I have is how are you going to keep up with the volume? I mean, there's so many different kinds of lamps and so many different kinds of products, and you have so many different people selling and retailing them, and then you have catalogs on top of that. How can you possibly, keep track of these things if they don't get into the hands of the consumer?
It's pretty difficult to keep track of all of our responsibilities that we have right now. You delegate, you use your resources in the most effective way you can. But frankly, what I've been doing for the last 2 months is every time I go into a Costco or Price Savers or Cars or wherever, my wife is complaining at me about how long it takes me to get through there because I'm looking at lamps.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With regards specifically to catalog sales, I mean, it would be fairly easy and fairly inexpensive but fairly painless to write a letter to all the folks that sell electrical products, and Sears and Penney's and all those would certainly be on the top of your list, and just a little blurb goes in their next catalog that says not available for sale in Alaska or something like that, and they wouldn't go into the reasons, but the person looking at the catalog would see that and might ask the question and might call somebody, but it seems that's a fairly easy thing to get at, that all the catalog folks who deal in these devices understood, and it shouldn't be expensive, I can't imagine, to notify catalog dealers.
Can I respond to it?
You certainly can.
I don't think enforcement of this is going to be a major problem. A little bit of consumer education, I think, is going to bring the merchants around. It's the exception to find the non-UL listed products. The vast majority of products are listed. In fact, up until a few years ago, you very, very, very seldom found any non-UL listed products. It's my understanding that only recently, since we're seeing many more consumer products coming in from third world nations, that maybe they're escaping the scrutiny of the UL, which, as my understanding, is being primarily enforced by the product liability laws of the country and or the insurance companies of the country that have said, if you want to buy product liability insurance, you better have a listed product, otherwise we're not covering it. So it's a small part of the marketplace, but they were being peddled in Alaska, and if we don't get the statute, it likely will be back again.
Representative Grimber.
Yeah, just to correct something I said a little earlier, there are two things in the UCC about this. One is the warranty, the express warranty for fitness, and then there's the express warranty of merchantability, which I think probably applies more than the warranty of fitness.
I would stress that I'm not an attorney, I'm an investigator.
So let me ask you, do we have a fiscal note from the Department of Law Consumer Protection?
There was one prepared this afternoon, sir.
Yeah, this is for consumer protection. It should be in the packet.
Oh, okay. All right. You got a zero fiscal note?
We get 28 unfair trade practices now that I enforce. I figured a 29 can't take it that much harder.
I should
bring up that as we see this thing, we don't expect to have a problem. There is one scenario where there is a potential problem, and I guess I should let the committee know of that. There's a section where we will review and approve certifying laboratories or programs. Mm-hmm. If we hear from Underwriters Lab, we hear from Factory Mutual, we hear from the other five or six programs that have been approved by Washington and Oregon, I'm not going to have any problem in very quickly going over what they do and seeing that we draft a letter of approval. If we start hearing from programs that may be scattered around the world that nobody's ever heard of before, there is a possibility we might be in a little bit of a battle. Trying to look at who these folks are and, in fact, do they comply with the ANSI requirement. It's a slim but a possibility.
Mr. Chairman, I am a little bit concerned, and I'm going to mention those magic words once again, tort reform, that if you don't make some checks, and determine, in fact, what the procedures have been to render these products safe on the market, and you approve them, there may be some very considerable tort liability for the state on a negligence theory, using your lack of procedures as an example. And that may yield particularly, let us say, let me give you an example. Let's say you got the ACE lamp-based manufacturing company in Podunk, Iowa, which has nothing, because it's gone out of business, having been sued in four states for electrocuting kids. You've got the Acme distributing company, which is also out of business. There may be only one target defendant, and that's the state of Alaska, in many of these circumstances. And I think you need to be extremely careful, because the state could face some substantial liability otherwise.
I appreciate the comment, sir. I'm going through that right now with another state agency, working with them on that exact aspect. And if I was the one making the decision, I would not be. It would be my supervisor, who is an attorney. And there was an error to be made. The error was being made towards having a safer consumer product and affecting the manufacturer.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, I'm looking at this subsection B in a different light from the rest of the bill. I know that you are given a great deal of discretion in the list of unfair trade practices in the prosecution and injunctive functions of your office. Is there anything else in the law that requires you to maintain a list of approved products? Do you do that anywhere else, or is this something that's totally unique to your office?
This law does not call for us to make a list of approved products.
It says shall maintain a list of approved laboratories.
Just laboratories.
There's something somewhat similar. It's not technical in nature. It is the approval of the third-party arbitration programs being offered by the motor vehicle manufacturers on the auspices of the Lemon Law. Being you brought it up, sir, we recognize that we're reaching in this aspect of the law. We don't necessarily have all the technical resources needed, and we're hoping that we'll be able to utilize, and we've had in the past, very good cooperation from the state of Washington authorities, the state of Oregon authorities, who adopted language similar to the language in this bill. We're going to be leaning on our neighbors again.
We should apologize.
Further questions for the non-lawyer?
Yeah, well, one time I was on a committee where, and being a lawyer, they said that we have five lawyers on this committee and two real people.
Further questions for the witness? Thanks for your testimony today. Did the Department of Transportation wish to testify?
I would testify. My name is Warren Rasmussen. I'm the chief of our design and construction standards with the Department of Transportation. I'll probably just start out by saying we fully support the intent of the bill, obviously, and the vast majority of the things that the Department of Transportation does, we do use UL labels and stuff. In fact, I just bought a couple of our standard specifications to show that we do require the UL labeling on most of our items that we specify in our contracts. But from time to time, there does come situations in which we cannot get a product that is UL labeled. It may be a specialized cabinet or something like that. In those cases, in every case, those components are designed by a registered professional engineer, and it has to be in the field that they're practicing. So in case electrical, it would be an electrical engineer. There are a couple other situations in which we have that you should be aware of. One was unique at one of our airports in which we had to use some very intense lighting systems, and they were manufactured, and we could not get the UL label on those. And we had to put them in, and they were something that was approved by FAA and part of their system. In addition, there has been some experimental lighting in the rural bush areas that we could not get UL light approval on some of the equipment that was designed by electrical engineers. And just to get that one time tested would have been very expensive and prohibitive to use that experimental process. So all I think the Department of Transportation is really looking for is some system that we can take care of the unusual and the exceptions to the process, and that's all we really want.
Questions?
Like
for the Cotton.
Yeah, and this is one of the reasons why I wanted to make sure these fellows from UL had a chance to come back up here, because your position paper suggests that a person from UL walked out, took a look at this
sheet metal box that says, yep, it's galvanized sheet metal and watertight, and it cost you $15,000 for them to say that. And I just wanted to see if I could get them to confirm that that's a typical UL inspector fee.
I wished I wasn't sitting here right now. I didn't write the position paper, but I do know that I talk with our construction chiefs quite a bit, and we just had them together a little while ago, and I know that they were complaining about the cost. I don't know where the $15,000 came from. If you actually need what it cost us in that specific instance, I can't dig those records out, but I do know it was expensive, and so I don't know where the $15,000 came from. It was written before I saw it. I can get the factual data, though, for you to tell you exactly what it did cost in that instance, and it was in Anchorage, and it was an electrical box.
I'm going to want to ask the UL folks.
Do you want to do that now?
Sure.
It might be convenient when they're both here.
Sure. The only other thing I did...
Do that now if you want.
Okay, yeah. Could we get a response?
Sure.
Sure, go ahead.
So it's engineers again.
The only other thing I did bring for you just
the reform
was the requirements for the laboratory standards. And we, too, had some questions for why you used that standard. It was a little bit unusual. So
sure. Have you seen the language we proposed?
No, I had not. So I won't start carrying those comments forward because it would make more sense what you proposed. But I did bring them so that in case you wanted to look what the original one was, what the requirements were.
Yeah.
And we would have thought that was a little unusual.
I stand corrected on that.
Did you want to make a comment?
Yes, I would say on this. We would not charge $15,000 to look at one box. We have sent a couple of engineers out to Dutch Harbor to look at a couple of different facilities to look at numerous pieces of electrical equipment, and it was less than $15,000. So I think there's maybe a couple of digits missing or decimal points misplaced there. Again, if you set up something for special permission or something like that, there are alternatives. If you can go to other laboratories. When we do investigations in Alaska, we try to plan them to go to groups so we can reduce the cost. We're very well aware of the cost of coming up here and doing business. We're trying to minimize that for the people who utilize our services. We try to make trips together with other clients. We've talked with the Department of Labor people to, you know, if there's a problem with an installation, we give them enough time to allow us to group some projects together so that the one person doesn't pay all the costs. So we're very cognizant of that. And like you said, this is not the case with UL where we charge this kind of fees.
Could I ask Mr. Rasmussen from the department to document for the information of the application of the committee maybe a little better what the expenses actually were involved here, and maybe ask the folks from UL to, if it's possible, to get some sort of whatever your book rates are or some sort of description of what a typical inspection fee might be so that we could have a better understanding of that financial responsibility.
When we said $15,000 representing time, I have a little better feel for actually what they were saying rather than just the inspection. And in these cases, it was that there was a delay to the project and it involved traffic signals and you had to get the inspection before you could turn them on and those kind of things. So when I think our people who wrote it were looking at the total cost, not just the inspection, it was $15,000 to the project to get their UL label on.
Chairman, to the person reading this, I wouldn't read that much between the lines. So
I know it, and that's why I wanted to apologize. And if you need the exact cost, I can get the regents to fill that out.
Yeah, I'd just like to point out that we asked for this position paper over a week ago. We didn't get it till the meeting had already started, so I didn't have any chance to ask any follow up questions. We just dropped on us here from the department. Representative Grimberg.
Yeah, this is, I think that the ramifications of this bill, and I'm really looking at the Department of Law, Mr. Dawkins here too, go somewhat beyond a lamp base or an electrical product that doesn't meet certain standards. Because UL and other national laboratories certify a whole range of different kinds of things, not only electrical things, right?
Correct.
And what we're doing here is getting into a new era that I have an area that we haven't really gotten into in this state. And that is what should be the official weight of failure to certify something by UL or any of these other nationally recognized laboratories. That's one issue. Second issue is who should do the enforcing. And if we're going to start doing this, it makes some sense to me to do it in a comprehensive way. And this may be a very good thing that we're doing, number one, to establish with the weight of law, other than just the common law, what may have occurred in courts around the state. And I do believe that they now do say a failure to get something certified may show that this is not a fit product or a defective product. I think that evidence is admissible. I'm not certain. I don't know. But this and the second thing is how we're going to implement it if, in fact, the intent of the law is to ensure that there is some method of keeping these products off the shelf. And we're talking about a proactive, kind of a prophylactic effect, as opposed to a reactive, compensatory approach. And if we're going to get the Department of Law involved in this, then the logical conclusion of this is that the Department of Law is going to be involved not only in electrical equipment and certification and testing and injunctive relief and the whole thing, but for chemicals, fire extinguishers, any other kinds of things you may certify. You may be involved with electrical toasters or electrical blenders or electrical light fixtures or electrical radios or whatever is electrical or not, you know. And my suggestion is simply raising that what we're doing here is going to have very significant precedent for a whole range of manufactured devices.
Yeah, Representative Grunberg, we're in the second session of this legislature. And, it seems to me like there's a pretty serious threat to people here, you know, that's been identified by this tragedy that's occurred. And it'd be nice if we could at least address, you know, I mean, the bill is a pretty straightforward, simple concept. I mean, the things sold in Alaska should be, you know, certified by one of these approved laboratories as being safe to sell. If we could just maybe focus on that for now, but I think certainly the wider scope of things, you know, needs to be looked at.
What we're doing here is then basically establishing the precedent that the Department of Law is going to be doing this, because the next session we're going to be looking at using this for other types of equipment and everything else. And once we have set up the Department of Law as doing this, the Consumer Protection Agency, with one paralegal and one lawyer and not a staff to do this, we are looking at really setting something up, and we should make sure it's set up correctly.
Okay. Are there any further questions for either of these two witnesses? Okay, thanks, gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
Well, there's
one question. Then with specific regard to their amended language, that recommend to accept the product specified by a person who's a registered electrical engineer, I mean, is that, would a person with that label have the ability or have the expertise or background to do the kind of work that you're doing?
Not necessarily, because of the fact that there is usually product testing involved in evaluation of the product and not just an inspection. A professional engineer would know how it should be used in the field, and it, depending on the type of product, it may be sufficient for an assemblage of listed parts into, say, a control panel or something of that nature, where you can look at the installation code and it pretty well covers it. There are a lot of cases where that wouldn't be the case, so this would be, in my opinion, would be too broad an exception. It should be limited to something called special permission that would be worked out with Department of Law, Department of Labor, whoever.
What if you limited it to your non-retail type things, your construction area?
That would depend on what the state would want to do. I'm certain to do that.
Well, at that point, does that make you happy?
I don't know quite what specific language you are, but that's what we're looking for, that type
okay.
of thing. We would surely work with the staff.
This is what I'm going to ask you to do. If you could draft some, if you could get us, like, the next committee meeting's on Thursday, and Representative Grunberg's going to chair that meeting because I'll be out of town, but if you can get us some language in a couple of days that would dichotomize between those two issues, you know, so that if what your suggestion would apply to non-retail products, okay, the committee could entertain it. That time. Can you do that?
Yes, we can do that.
Okay. Representative Boyer?
Just think about it. Beverly, did you have a comment?
I had signed up, but I would like to say a few words if I could, Mr. Chairman.
Well, okay. Representative Collins, do you have something?
I have a question for Mr. Pollack. one of the things, the questions I raised earlier was what this would include, the sale of like hair dryers and, you know, lamps and things, and vacuum cleaners and garage sales. So what do states have exclusions for things like that? Because I'm thinking, like, if you take like the Bishop's Attic, they take in a lot of appliances or electrical appliances. I do know they check them over, but I don't know if they check them over to the degree that they would be safe. How do you get around that? I can see a big hue and cry coming from those people, is what I'm saying.
I can't answer specifically what's on those laws regarding those garage sale type activities. I do know.